I want to talk to you today about what I call epistemic reparations. So the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established in 1995 to investigate human rights violations that took place under apartheid. The mandate of the commission was to investigate and record gross abuses of human rights between 1960 and 1994, to offer reparation and rehabilitation to victims, and when appropriate, to grant amnesty to perpetrators. One of the people who was interviewed by the commission, Lucas Baba Sikwapere, recounted having been shot multiple times by an apartheid-era police officer, which led to multiple bullets being lodged in his neck and face, causing blindness and severe headaches. When the commissioner asked him, "How do you feel, Baba, about coming here to tell your story?" Sikwapere responded, "I feel what has been making me sick all the time is the fact that I couldn't tell my story. But now it feels like I got my sight back by coming here and telling you the story." Of course, Sikwapere did not literally regain his sight by testifying to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Instead, he is communicating that something powerful or transformative occurred through the act of telling his story. But notice that telling is here being understood not only as distinctively interpersonal, but also as a success term. It's clear that Sikwapere would not have had the experience he had if he told his story with no listener or if the audience members ignored him. He didn't want to just utter words into the void. He needed to be listened to and heard by other people. Otherwise put, Sikwapere needed to be known in order to feel like he got his sight back. Now, this is a common reaction. The act of telling and being heard, especially after suffering gross violations or injustice, reflects a deep human desire for many people. In Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, she provides a first-person narrative of Oluwole Kassala, the last known survivor of the Middle Passage. Kassala recounts his life in a West African village, his abduction by slave traders, and the profound trauma and grief he experienced at the loss of his home and family. Hurston explains that she would like to tell Kassala's story in the book. She tells him this, and he cries out with joy that he wants to convey who he is so one day in Africa, his name will be called and somebody will respond, "Yeah, I know Kassala." In Ismail Muhammad's review of Neale Hurston's book, he writes, "Kassala's narrative is marked by a deep familiarity with violence and an irreversible sense of loneliness and loss. We sense the monumental contours of his grief, not only at the deaths of his wife and children, but also at the gaping wound that resulted from being torn from a home to which he will never return. His utmost desire is to be known again." Commissioner Thomas Bergenthal, who was a commissioner for the United Nations Truth Commission for El Salvador, writes, "Many of the people who came to the commission to tell what happened to them or to their relatives and friends had not done so before. For some, 10 years or more had gone by in silence and pent-up anger. Finally, someone listened to them, and there would be a record of what they had endured. They came by the thousands, still afraid and not a little skeptical, and they talked, many of them, for the first time. One could not listen to them without recognizing that the mere act of telling what had happened was a healing emotional release, and that they were more interested in recounting their story and being heard than in retribution." This is not unique to paradigmatic cases of human rights violations. And in fact, when I started thinking about epistemic reparations under that heading of epistemic reparations, it was really sparked by many people that I know who have been wrongfully convicted. So Louis Jim Fogel served 34 years for the 1976 murder and rape of a 15-year-old girl in Pennsylvania, Deanne Catherine Long. The conviction was based largely on the testimony of a jailhouse informant. And in 2014, DNA testing excluded Fogle as the contributor of the male DNA found at the scene. Now, despite the fact that Fogle was released from prison and exonerated in 2015, when he was interviewed, he said that there's something else that he wants, something more powerful even than his freedom. I want people to know the truth about my case. Knowing the truth about his case is to know the truth about him, that he did not take the life of Long and is thus not a murderer and a rapist. In other words, even after the external injustices of incarceration and wrongful conviction have been reversed, there is a further desire that Fogle has, and that's to be known. Now, the cases that we've looked at are intrapersonal cases where someone has the desire to be known for themselves. But there are also plenty of examples of this at the interpersonal level. Say their names is a common cry among those protesting America's pernicious investment in policing, criminalization, and incarceration. But notice that this call to say the names of victims is not a call to simply utter words or to shout a refrain. It is rather to do something epistemic. It's to know the victims, to remember them, and to bear witness to them. So it matters not just that we know that there are victims of police violence, but that we know them. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, and so many others. So being known is important at both the intrapersonal level and the interpersonal level. Now, being known the way that I'm using that today and being listened to is not purely instrumental in these cases. Rather, it's an end in itself. Now, to be sure, reporting gross violations and injustices is often a means to end the preventing of these same abuses from happening to others in the future, or to educate the public about atrocities and so on. But in the above cases, the victims in question are highlighting the need or wish to be known as independent from these other downstream aims. So my aim for today is to provide a discussion of the epistemic significance of being known and the relationship that it has to reparations that I'm going to claim are distinctively epistemic. I'm going to draw on and expand a framework provided by the United Nations of the right to know. And I'm going to argue that victims of gross violations and injustices also have the right to be known, to be a giver of knowledge to others about their own experiences. I'm going to show how such victims can suffer epistemic wrongs by being rendered invisible, vilified, or demonized, or systematically distorted, and that these particular ways of not being known demand epistemic reparations. And I'm going to conclude by sketching a picture to underwrite this notion of epistemic reparations, one that significantly expands the traditional picture in epistemology by including epistemic duties that are imperfect in nature and which concerns actions in addition to beliefs. So the way I'm understanding being known is that it's a distinctively interpersonal phenomenon. So it involves the one who knows and the one who is being known. It's also factive. One can't know what's false. So if you are known by another, this involves the person having at least some true beliefs about you. Now, there are different ways of being known. We can be known in the sense of achieving popularity or fame. We can be known in the sense of having an intimate relationship, which involves knowing who you are in a deep and meaningful way, and that may be determined by feeling truly understood or appreciated by another person. You might be known by being accurately represented, or you might be seen or heard in that you have others bear witness to your experiences. And it's this last sense of bearing witness to someone that I'm most interested in today. Now, in 1997, the United Nations Commission on Human Rights issued a report that addressed the impunity of perpetrators of civil and political human rights violations. And they identified three principles for the protection and promotion of human rights through actions that combat impunity. They identified these as the right to know, the right to justice and the right to reparation. I'm going to be focusing on the first, the right to know. Now, the right to know, this is from this UN commission, they say, this is not simply the right of any individual victim or his nearest and dearest to know what happened, a right to the truth. The right to know is also a collective right, drawing upon history to prevent violations from recurring in the future. And the knowledge in question in this report involves the occurrence, causes, circumstances, and perpetrators of gross human rights violations and breaches of international humanitarian law. The bearers of these rights are victims, their families, communities, society, or a people. Now, in 2005, this report was updated to include a further kind of development of what the right to know amounts to. And in it said that victims and their families have the imprescriptible right to know the truth about the circumstances in which violations took place, and in the event of death or disappearance, the victim's fate. And it also said that it's an inalienable right of every people to know about the perpetration and circumstances surrounding heinous crimes. Now, these two aspects of the report concern right bearers and the nature of the rights. But there are also corresponding duties of states or governments, of the states or governments in question. So states or governments have the duty to make knowable, okay, the relevant information. So they have the duty to preserve memory, which involves the preservation of archives and other evidence concerning violations of human rights and humanitarian law, and the facilitation of knowledge of these violations, including protecting the collective memory from extinction and guarding against the development of revisionist and negationist views. So there are four features that I think emerge from this UN framework that I think are particularly interesting for our purposes today. The first is that possessing certain kinds of knowledge is a right that belongs to individuals and communities. The second is that there can be a right to something distinctively epistemic in nature. The third is that the right in question here is an inalienable natural right, one that is not dependent on law, culture, or government and cannot be repealed. And the right is connected to gross violations and injustices often perpetrated by states, governments, or groups. Now, I think this framework is powerful, not only for what it includes, but also for what it leaves out. So what I want to use this framework for is to explore some of the kind of examples that I started off with, where I was suggesting that there, in those cases, there was a desire to be known. And I want to use this framework to suggest that when victims are when people have been the victims of gross violations or injustices, that this framework can be used to also understand the right to be known and the duty to know. So absent from the UN picture is, I think, another right dimension of rights and duties that I think is just as significant as those highlighted in the UN report. And as I said, that is the right to be known and the corresponding duty to see, hear, or bear witness what I'm saying, calling to be known. Now, here are some contrasts between the right to know and the right to be known. So the right to know involves a knower and a proposition or propositions, and so it need not be interpersonal. For instance, it can be fulfilled by making available, even through like video footage, impersonally captured, certain facts or truths. But the right to be known is an overtly interpersonal phenomenon. Given that it doesn't make sense to be known by an impersonal object, being known requires at least two persons at the most fundamental level, the knower and the one being known. The right to know has the corresponding duty to tell. Since people have a right to know about gross human rights violations, for instance, the state has a responsibility to do things to enable the creation, preservation, and transmission of knowledge. And here there is the implicature of at least partial ignorance on the part of those most harmed. Victims, their families, and communities have a right to know about gross human rights violations, so the state has the duty to investigate, remember, and archive so as to uncover and make available what really happened and who was involved. In contrast, the right to be known has the corresponding duty to hear or know. It's not just that people have a right to know what happened to victims in certain contexts, it's also that these very victims have a right to be seen and heard, to have their stories be given proper uptake. There's no implicature here of ignorance on the part of the victim. They don't need to be given access to truths or facts. Instead, they need to be able to be givers of knowledge, and this requires the listening of others. So knowing in these cases, I want to say, is an end in itself. Now, of course, when the UN talks about the right to know, there is a sense in which listening to victims and their families is included, right? We can't know all of the details of what really happened regarding human rights violations without the testimony of those most impacted by the crimes. But listening to the victims is only one way to fulfill the rights of those who are ignorant. And this, on the view that I'm suggesting today, hearing the testimony of victims is an end in itself. Now, the UN's framework for understanding the right to know, I think, can be crucially expanded to include this right to be known. So let's take a closer look at the case of Fogel. And as I said, wrongful convictions are really many of the cases that first got me thinking about what it means from an epistemic point of view to bear witness. Now, Fogel was not only convicted of murder and incarcerated for decades, he was also denied a voice in the epistemic community. He was doubted, he was silenced, he was forbidden from playing a credible role in his own defense. Because of this, he wasn't heard or listened to, and he was not seen for who he is. Instead, he was falsely believed to be a liar, a rapist, and a murderer. The community both failed to know who he was and believed him to be something altogether different, someone who is a pariah in the community and is alien to Fogel himself. Now, justice for Fogel involves not only release from prison, exoneration, and financial compensation, but also repairing his fractured relationship within the epistemic community. We need to hear him, believe him, and see him for who he truly is, not as the person presented to us by the state. We need, that is, to know him. Now, reparations can be understood as intentionally reparative actions in the form of goods given to those wronged by parties who acknowledge responsibility for wrongs and whose reparative actions are intended to redress those wrongs. Martha Minow invokes the ideal of restorative justice to understand reparations. The goal of reparations is to repair injustice or to make up for it and to implement future changes to correct the injustice. Now, reparations are offered to individuals and to collectives or communities who have been wronged. They're also traditionally either material or symbolic, involving, for instance, monetary payments, health and social services, and restitution of property on the one hand, and public apologies and memorials on the other. So reparations can be understood as actions made to acknowledge and redress wrongs to individuals or collectives in the form of material or symbolic goods. Now, reparations are understood to have three different aims, broadly speaking: legal and political, psychosocial, and moral. So legal and political aims include the restoration of citizenship and liberty, the reinstatement of jobs and benefits, the restitution of property, and ensuring public status and recognition. The psychosocial involve relieving suffering, distress, anger, powerlessness, and the sense of violation experienced by victims and their family members. And the moral include recognizing and restoring the dignity of victims and reaffirming or reestablishing the moral order of a community. But there's a crucial dimension missing from all of these discussions, I want to suggest, and that's the epistemic. We can be wronged not only legally, politically, psychologically, and morally, but also epistemically. We are members of an epistemic community in addition to a legal, political, and moral community. We are not just agents in a political and moral sense, but also an epistemic one. And we have epistemic duties distinct from our legal and moral obligations. Now, I want to suggest that there are three ways of not being known that can demand epistemic reparations. None of the harms that are wrongs that I'm going to be identifying are new. There is a lot of really good literature right now on, there has been for decades, I think, on identifying a broad range of ways in which people can be wronged or harmed. I'm going to just go through a few, but to kind of give us a context for understanding when epistemic reparations are demanded. So three different ways, this is not exhaustive: invisibility, vilification and demonization, and systematic distortion. The first is invisibility. So if I don't have any relevant beliefs about you because you are invisible to me, especially as a person, then ipso facto, I don't know you. The narrator in Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man says, "White people refuse to see me. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me." Now, there are two different ways, I think, broadly speaking, of course, I don't mean this to be exhaustive, of being rendered invisible. Targeted invisibility involves knowing some facts about a person, but lacking relevant beliefs about them in a particular domain, especially ones that are important to the person, such as coworker, political participant, member of the moral community, and so on. Complete invisibility involves lacking beliefs about a person as a person, which is often found in cases of the dehumanization of a racial or ethnic group during times of mass genocide. Vilification and demonization involves replacing the image of a person with an inaccurate and vilified or demonized version. So in the case of Fogel that we started with, it is not that he was invisible to investigators, prosecutors, and the judge and jury, but he was regarded as a liar and thus as a murderer and rapist of a child. So he was vilified or demonized. This sort of epistemic harm is widespread in the United States, where Black Americans are systematically represented and treated as, quote, criminals. In this sense, they are not invisible at all, for it's not that they are erased from consciousness, but massively overrepresented in inaccurate and vilified ways. And the criminalization of Black Americans, both in representation and in over-policing and over-incarcerating, is not only a political and moral wrong, but also an epistemic one in this sense. And then there's systematic distortion. I think this quote from Audre Lorde is just really powerful in making this clear. "It's not that we haven't always been here since there was a here," she writes. "It is that the letters of our names have been scrambled when they were not totally erased, and our fingerprints upon the handles of history have been called the random brushing of birds." And in this way, it is not that Black women, the way that Audre Lorde is understanding it, are erased or vilified or demonized. It's just that there's this systematic distortion of who they are. Now, having one's testimony dismissed, ignored, rejected, or swamped in these ways can lead to downstream epistemic, being rendered invisible, demonized, vilified, or distorted can have these downstream epistemic wrongs. So for instance, if one erased, for instance, then one's testimony will be rejected, ignored, also be rendered invisible. In Fogel's case, for instance, his statements about his own innocence and the evidence in support of this were ignored for decades and by people at every stage of the criminal legal system, including investigators, prosecutors, juries, and judges. It's quite a common epistemic wrong suffered by members of marginalized or targeted communities, especially when they are reporting facts about their own experiences that run counter to the narrative of those in power. So having one's testimony treated in this way gives rise to further epistemic wrongs, such as having lower status within the community, being denied opportunities for making epistemic contributions, not having trusting relationships, and so on. But we also can see an impact on people themselves that we might think of as something of a metaphysical impact, because how we are seen by others will very likely have an impact on who we in fact become. So Charles Horton Cooley was writing in 1902, and he had put forth this highly influential looking glass self theory, according to which our conception of self is formed as a reflection of the responses and evaluations of others in our environment. And so if this is true, who we are is fundamentally shaped by how we think we appear to those around us. Du Bois, who was writing around the same time, writes, "It's a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity." Now, it's crucial that, unlike Cooley, Du Bois is not discussing a universal or equally shared experience here. He writes, "One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." So in contrast to Cooley, Du Bois argues that the racist and unjust structure of the United States forces Black Americans to see themselves through the eyes of others in a way that it does not for white Americans. There's also an unequal distribution. So neither the benefits of being seen by others nor the burden of doing the seeing is equally distributed among members of our community. So James Baldwin writes, "I've spent most of my life, after all, watching white people and outwitting them so that I might survive." So there's three points that emerge. Ourselves are powerfully shaped by how we think we are seen by others. And so interpersonal relations are fundamental to our identities, even if we don't take on board something as strong as the looking glass self theory. Certainly how we think we're seen by others impacts who we are, who we become. Being seen or known is not an equally distributed good. Those with less power are often seen or known far less than those with more. And the labor involved in doing the seeing and knowing is not equally shared among members of our communities, as those in relative positions of powerlessness frequently need to know those who have power in order to navigate the world around them. But those in power can often avoid this epistemic work. Now, as I said, even if we don't accept this kind of very strong theory, regarding ourselves as invisible, demonized, or systematically distorted by other members of our community will very likely have a metaphysical impact on who we in fact become. I think this is just a really powerful way that Hilda Lindemann puts it. We are initiated into personhood through interactions with other persons, and we simultaneously develop and maintain personal identities through interactions with others who hold us in our identities. This holding can be done well or badly. Done well, it supports an individual in the creation and maintenance of a personal identity that allows her to flourish personally and in her interactions with others. Done badly, we hold people in invidious, destructive narratives. Some such narratives identify the social group to which someone belongs as socially and morally inferior, and in that way, the stories uphold abusive power relations between us and them. Now, just as descendants may inherit wealth or property, they may also inherit an erased, vilified, or distorted history. So Janet Thompson writes, "When a nation is dispossessed, this is not only a great evil to existing members, it harms their successors, robbing them of the inheritance to which they are entitled, and by so doing, disrupts their ability to carry on their common life. Nothing but the return of their national territory counts as appropriate reparation for this wrong." Now, Thompson is here talking about the inheritance of land, but we can extend her thoughts to the realm of the epistemic. So not only do we inherit, kind of a physical history, but we also inherit an epistemic one. Black Americans, for instance, inherit not just the material consequences of slavery and Jim Crow, but also the epistemic ones, which is replete with erasure, vilification, and distortion. Even at the individual level, the intergenerational impact of the failure to be known can be powerful. Without knowing Fogel, for instance, his children... Is there a problem? I'm sorry? It's good. Thanks. His children and grandchildren are handed a public story in which their father and grandfather is a murderer and rapist. There's also intergenerational responsibility. I'm gonna not read the Ta-Nehisi Coates quote, even though I really like it, just because I've got a lot more to go through. But those who profit from the oppression and abuse of others pass down the privilege, power, and benefits that result from the relevant institution and acts to their descendants. And so not only is there intergenerational harm, but there's also intergenerational responsibility. Now, there are at least two reasons why the right to know, the duty to hear or know, and the wrongs that result from the failure to fulfill this right all include distinctively epistemic dimensions. The good in question is knowledge, and so the right to be known is the right for an epistemic good. The epistemic also plays a role in terms of the right and the duty to know. Being invisible in whole or in part, being vilified or demonized, or being systematically distorted erases or banishes people from the epistemic community. They are denied the status of epistemic personhood, and in so doing, they are prevented from fully exercising their epistemic agency. They can't engage in the giving and receiving of knowledge, including about their own identities, and they can't enter into trusting relationships. So in cases of gross violations or injustices that involve not being known due to one of these three ways, I want to suggest that distinctively epistemic reparations are needed. Epistemic reparations are epistemic when they are goods, when the goods and the wrongs in question involve knowledge, broadly speaking. So more precisely, epistemic reparations are intentionally reparative actions in the form of epistemic goods given to those epistemically wronged by parties who acknowledge responsibility for these wrongs and whose reparative actions are intended to redress them. Now, traditional epistemic reparations, even though they're not called that, right? I mean, it's not like you see this in any of the UN documents or the literature. I think at least three can be regarded as distinctively epistemic: public apologies, memorialization, and education. So I included this, it's in my written work, but I wanted to make sure I included this here because the conference is here in Chicago. So for those of us from Chicago, we're probably well acquainted with the John Birch torture victims. So between 1972 and 1991, over 120 people, predominantly Black, were tortured under the command of notorious Chicago Police Department commander John Birch. In May of 2015, Chicago became the first city in the United States to provide reparations for racially motivated police violence when the Chicago City Council unanimously passed the reparations ordinance. The ordinance includes distinctively epistemic reparations, even though it doesn't say that. It included a formal apology from the mayor, who was then Rahm Emanuel, and City Council of Chicago for the torture inflicted on victims. It requires a permanent public memorial acknowledging the torture, which has not been done yet, and there's some dragging of the feet on this, and inclusion of a lesson on the Birch torture cases in the Chicago Public Schools 8th and 10th grade U.S. history curriculum. Now, I think it's crucial that we acknowledge the distinctively epistemic dimension of these reparations. Victims and their communities need to be made whole, not just in the ways that are very familiar to us, but also epistemically. They need the wrongs to be acknowledged, they need to be told the truth, they need to know what happened, and they need to have an accurate history documented and remembered. Indeed, in many cases, other kinds of reparations are dependent on the epistemic ones. But the right to be known is a prior and just as important epistemic reparation. Before we can properly acknowledge and apologize, memorialize and educate, we need to listen and bear witness. We need to know victims not as merely a means to the ends of fulfilling the right of others to know, but as an end in itself. Now, we might ask, what if someone doesn't want to be known? And there are lots of people who have been victimized who don't want to be known. If this is a right, as with other rights, they can be waived. I have the right to kind of bear arms, and I don't exercise that right. I waive that right. So as with other rights, rights can be waived. Now, one contrast between the right to know and the right to be known is that it doesn't matter for the right to know how the knowledge is made available, just that it is. And in contrast, the right to be known needs to have what we can call a proximate source, which is a source of knowledge sufficiently close to the victim or the victim, him or herself. And there's at least three reasons why proximate sources are critical in the context of epistemic reparations. The first is that proximate sources have epistemic power. Brian Stevenson frequently uses this phrase, and I think it's a very powerful one. He says, justice requires getting proximate to people who are suffering because they understand the problems of injustice in a direct way, and they possess a critical perspective regarding not only the ills of our society, but also their possible solutions. So this, for those of you who have heard Stevenson's TED Talks and stuff, this is a famous thing, get proximate, right? Like, get proximate to the suffering and the injustices in the world. He writes, in brokenness, you understand something about compassion. It is the broken who understand the way justice really needs to work. It is the broken who understand why we need mercy. It is the broken who can show us how we make our commitment to justice actionable. So Stevenson is here suggesting that experiences of violation and suffering often afford one with epistemic insight. I'm just going to skip this. I think that it's pretty clear. Also, I think that proximate sources have epistemic authority. Those who are closest to the injustices will often have authority. I think that epistemic insight is one thing, and I think authority is another. If there's like a disagreement and one, you know, kind of person, if there's a disagreement about like incarceration and like what it's like, I think that oftentimes with that disagreement, you should, you know, kind of defer to the person who has the direct insight into the question. And also when we're thinking about epistemic equity, when we're urged to center the voices of those who've been harmed or wronged by social institutions, it's not just a moral request. It's also an appeal to provide space within the epistemic community for those who have been systematically erased or distorted within it. Now, I want to end with some concrete examples of epistemic reparations. When we do philosophy, oftentimes we just provide theories and kind of we publish papers, but I'm gonna give everyone in here today two ways of engaging in epistemic reparations in the upcoming week. The first is to talk about a friend of mine, Albert Kirkman. He was wrongfully convicted of, well, two murders and the shooting of a third person who survived. As a child, he was a teenager. He was a young teenager. Based on an extracted eyewitness misidentification. So literally, the prosecutors put out a warrant for the arrest of the person who survived the shooting to get him to testify against Albert and his co-defendant. Albert spent 28 years behind bars. He was only released very recently at the start of the pandemic when Governor Pritzker granted him clemency. Despite the fact that the only eyewitness who identified Albert recanted in 2009. Okay. So Albert is home now, trying to kind of rebuild his life. So this upcoming Thursday, Albert is going to be giving a talk about eyewitness misidentifications. It's available via Zoom, and I think that this is one of the ways of engaging in epistemic reparations for those who have been victims of gross violations or injustices. Okay? Albert is going to be speaking alongside an attorney who has taken on wrongful conviction cases based on eyewitness misidentifications, and one of the leading social psychologists looking at all of the social psychology behind eyewitness misidentifications. It's this Thursday, this upcoming Thursday, and we can all bear witness to Albert and what the state of Illinois did to Albert by listening to him talk about eyewitness misidentifications and his own firsthand experience. Second case. Literally today, this was not done intentionally. Keith Lamar, who's a friend of mine who's on death row in Ohio, who has an execution date for a year from this November, released a CD. I don't know what you call it now, but is that, anyway, a CD on all the streaming platforms, okay? It dropped today. It is the only record, or whatever you call it, that has been composed and completely done by someone who is on death row. And in this kind of recording, Keith does a lot of spoken word poetry, and he credits jazz with saving his life on death row, literally, that he doesn't think he would make it, wouldn't have made it. So this is a way that we can all, I think, bear witness. And I mean, if you want to know more about Keith's case, I'd be happy to share it with you. He's been in solitary confinement for decades in Ohio for what absolutely looks like a wrongful conviction. So those are two concrete ways that you can bear witness to a gross violation or injustice, but these are just people that I know because of the work that I do. So there are lots of ways in your own communities and in your own kind of circles where you can engage actively in epistemic reparations. Now, I'm gonna skip this. This is just it's a lot of philosophy, and if you wanna talk more, I'm happy to talk about it over a drink. Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up. So when Sikwa Perry and Fogel express a desire to be known, and when those who protest the systemic racism of policing in America cry out to see their names, I think it's crucial that we see the true normative force at work here. These aren't expressions of mere personal preferences or demands to utter words. These are statements of powerful and legitimate epistemic claims being made by or on behalf of those who have suffered serious wrongs. I provided some first steps for understanding the nature of these claims. Those who suffer gross violations and injustices that result in invisibility, vilification, and demonization, or systematic distortion, have been epistemically wronged and have the epistemic right to be known. We, in turn, owe them epistemic reparations, the most fundamental of which is to know them. It is only by listening and bearing witness, by saying their names, that we can truly begin to repair the epistemic damage done to victims in our communities who've been harmed the most. Thank you.
It is APA tradition that the presidential address does not include a Q&A, so we invite you to join us for a reception outside celebrating our president, and please join me again in giving a round of applause to Jennifer Lackey.